So, back in December, I had the opportunity to visit IWC in Schaffhausen to get a sneak peek at the novelties they'd be releasing a few weeks later at the SIHH. As you already know by now, the brand's focus this year is on its pilot's watches, and in particular, a new crop of Spitfire models. The smaller sizes, the mix of steel and bronze cases, and the military styling are all great. You can count me as a fan. The highlight of my trip, though, wasn't seeing the new watches. It was actually a conversation I got to have with IWC CEO Chris Granger. He's one of the more interesting people in this strange little industry of ours. Chris is an architect and designer by training, and get this, he first got involved with IWC when the agency he worked for was contracted to work on a boutique for the brand. They were so impressed by him that he was actually asked to formally join the company in 2006, and after working in a few different departments, he was named CEO in 2017. Not a bad trajectory, right? We sat down to talk in the company's new manufacturer on the outskirts of Schaffhausen, a building that Chris himself actually designed. Of course, we talked about the new Spitfire collection, but we also get into what makes Chris tick, how his background in architecture informs what he does in his current position, and his abiding passion for collecting Hot Wheels cars. Yeah, this isn't your usual CEO interview, I promise. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio.
Thanks so much for joining us. It's good to be back here in Schaffhausen.
Well, thank you, Stephen. Thank you for being in Schaffhausen again, and thank you for coming to see our new manufacturing center.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually a good place for us to start, I think, is the new manufacturer. Can you tell us a little bit about where you and I are sitting right now?
Yeah, so we are in the new 13,000 square meter extension to our manufacturing right here at the outskirts of Schaffhausen. We've been in our historic building ever since Jones built it when he came over to Switzerland back in 1874. It was the first centralized industrial watch manufacturer in the whole of Switzerland. And since then, we've expanded only between the old town center of Schaffhausen and the River Rhine. So very restricted, and the only way to expand was basically vertically. Yeah. And as you can imagine, for a modern manufacturing site, it's not the most efficient way to organize watchmaking.
Sure.
So we took this opportunity to say, look, what would we do if we could design manufacturing completely from scratch and almost start with a blank canvas? And this led us to this site where we have the space to build and to expand. And from there, we created three things. We created a very flexible and modern, ergonomically modern manufacturing, which houses our case making, our movement part making, and our movement assembly. And at the same time, we created something that is the beating heart of IWC, that expresses us as a brand, and where the visitor experience has been designed into from step one. It hasn't come as an afterthought, but we really tried to figure out how can we show the entire process from a raw bar of metal to a finished watch case, finished watch movement in very, very easy to follow logical steps. And that's what we've got here.
Yeah, I think that last part is particularly interesting because, I mean, we at Hodinkee are very fortunate. We spend a lot of time in watch factories, and often they're not designed to have visitors. You kind of feel like you're trying to like step over someone's bench to get to something else.
Exactly.
Have you found that bringing clients and press and other people to the manufacturer has become a bigger part of what you do over the last few years?
Absolutely. I think we've always been very open door focused and very open and transparent as a watch manufacturer anyway. But to really be able to bring up to 10,000 guests here to Schaffhausen and show them with how much passion, precision and creativity these watches are being made, I think is the by far the best sales argument that we can possibly put forward. And so that's something we really focus on, yes.
Do you remember the first time you went to a watch manufacturer?
Yeah, it would have been IWC back in 2005.
And oh, really?
It's as you describe, you know, it was mostly something that was installed afterwards and that you did have to climb over all sorts of things to try and figure out, and you have to walk around machines to see what actually goes on the other side. And here we really split up the teams into two. So we had one team looking at the most efficient and best way to lay out the manufacturing. And the other team would focus on how to do it so that visitors can really see how it works. And then it was the discussion between those two teams that led us to the layout you experience today.
And when you made that first visit, were you working for the company yet?
No, I started actually designing the museum for IWC as an external interior designer back in 2005 to 2006.
Okay.
And then I joined in late 2006. So no, I was a visitor really.
Okay. Yeah, and that's something I also wanted to talk about is, you know, you're the CEO of this company, but you don't come from a traditional watch CEO background.
No, not quite. Not quite. No, I'm a designer by training. And it's exactly how I came to IWC, is first designing things like the museum and then later focusing on boutiques, trade exhibitions, factory offices and all the rest of it. And basically given the brand, it's three-dimensional spatial expression beyond products, basically.
So you're a designer and architect by training?
Yes, correct, yeah.
And when did you get interested in design and architecture?
Oh, from a very early age, I think even when I was a child, I spent most of my free time designing things. I was really into sports equipment then, mountain bikes, snowboards, yachts even. And then sort of mid-teenage years, I started to draw movie sets and to do a lot about movie storytelling, designing sets, designing costumes, designing props. And that was really what, you know, my sort of dream world where I spent my spare time back in those days. And I think when you go into watchmaking then and what we do with transporting people into this atmosphere at SIHH, that as we do every year, it's very closely linked to basically movie and set design. So it was quite a natural fit.
And what sorts of things were you designing and building before you met up with IWC and ended up at the company?
My career before that was about a year and a half, so it's okay. Fairly brief. So I worked on some high-end offices for people like Ernst & Young and Accenture. I helped to design a golf club and a couple of hospitality projects, restaurants and bars. But really, it was quite brief. And then we got this phone call, would you like to pitch for an IWC museum? And I felt right at home because in my gap year at uni, I'd done a sort of hard luxury retail store in London, and I really felt comfortable with showcasing these little objects in the most dramatic way, in a very luxurious way. I felt right at home there. It was sort of this engineering scenography type of thing between showcase and lighting design and just making the whole space like have a really standout atmosphere. And I knew that this area of design was of great interest to me. And then when this museum project started, I felt right at home.
And where did your kind of architectural and design inspirations come from? What were some architects or designers who you early on kind of were drawn to, or particular styles you were drawn to?
Yeah, I think my background is really, I would say, in the forward-looking modernism that was classically informed. You know, and I know it's a very obvious thing to say, but for us, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe was somebody I identified with very early on because it was modern and forward-looking, but it was based on classical training. It was not deconstructivist, disruptive in terms of breaking with the past and having a whole social agenda behind. It was really to say, how can I use traditional materials and techniques in a modern, uncluttered and forward-looking way? And that's the type of design that I really enjoyed. And then I think over time, this led very much to, you know, the times when I started university around 1999, 2000, this was the heyday of the great Dutch architects and also the Swiss architects like Herzog de Meuron, Peter Zumthor, etc. And they're people who clearly influenced me while I was studying design. You know, it's that sort of high-end material modernism, I would call it, but still providing uplifting environments. You know, I can't identify with anything brutalist or sort of anti-human. I like welcoming and uplifting buildings because I think your spatial environment you live in, you work in, has a huge factor on how you feel. And a lot of, you know, when people always say, oh, why do people get aggressive in public transport spaces? Well, are you surprised? I mean, look at them. You know, often when I look at typical metro station and tube stations, I'm surprised that people start being aggressive in those spaces because they are genuinely causing stress. And I think through the way we design space, we can positively influence people's behavior, and it gives you a wholly different outlook on life. So it's very important.
And what do you think makes a space create that kind of behavior, a positive behavior? What makes a space uplifting and inviting and sort of warm?
Well, one of the main elements is clearly spatial situation. That has to do with environmental psychology. It's very basic notions of fight or flight and protection in humans, what we're looking for, shelter. It's often very basic things. You know, when you look at how you'd find a space in a restaurant, it's much more inviting to sit in a sheltered booth where you've got, you know, two walls and, you know, a snug little cozy corner than you'd like an exposed table in the middle of the restaurant with 200 other tables around you. And that's to do with very basic animalistic instincts of security and safety and fight or flight. People like to be uplifted. They like to rise up. You know, why do we like to climb mountains and look down? Because this whole process of uplifting gives us a positive feeling, and we feel superior, and we feel emotionally elated, I would say, in a sense. And then lighting, of course, you know, what sort of ambience you set with music, sound, smell, that all plays to your subconscious well-being. And when you look also at the principles of Feng Shui, yes, not everybody may agree with that, but when you look at how we respond to that, like on a subconscious level, there's a lot of truth in those principles, and they make us either feel good or they make us feel stressed.
Are there any of those principles that stand out to you as ones you particularly remember or ones that kind of sit in the back of your mind as you're designing spaces?
Yeah, I think I've always worked with elevation. I've always, in everything, when you look at our SIHH booth, our boutique concepts, we have level changes in most of the designs. First thing when you come into the manufacturing center is you get a meter 10 difference from the forecourt onto the platform that carries the building. And it's that initial 6-7 steps up, and you're already on a platform. You already have a vantage point. You're already looking down at things. And that immediately changes your perception of where you are compared to just being stuck at ground level.
And let's talk a little bit about this building for people who haven't seen it. We'll link up in the show notes here to our coverage of the opening, because I was here over the summer to see the opening. Can you walk us through the kind of basic principle? I mean, you know, you needed a new manufacturing center. It had to be efficient. It had to be, you know, it had to provide the right industrial circumstances. But from there, it really could have been a lot of things. How did you arrive at this?
So one of the basic ideas was to go with a conceptual idea of a pavilion. And this was informed not only by the lightness and airiness of the structure, but also by the fact that pavilion architecture was traditionally used to showcase in these world expos the best of a country's science, mechanical engineering, inventions, cultural production, art, and all the rest of it. And mechanical watches being sort of somewhere in between cultural production and art and mechanical engineering, we felt that the pavilion as a basic idea was very powerful. And then I wanted something that felt a lot more residential, I would say, compared to being just a factory, because it needed to be the house of IWC. So I wanted certain cues, like the way the windows are done, the sun blinds are done, the materials are done, that are more reminiscent of maybe a hotel environment than they are of a factory. And generally what we did is we created a pavilion with cantilever overhangs in the roof and floor structure to give us natural daylight modulation, because there's nothing worse than glass cube factories where you have to lower the blinds all day, every day, and you're in a closed off block. Here you create this sort of sun visor effect through these protruding roofs that allows you to really actually see the daylight rather than having to block it off. Yeah. And then we said, okay, let's have the visitor path and the entrance area, and the central core of the building is all in warmer materials and in wood and more what you know from a boutique environment. And then the actual manufacturing space, which is more towards the window, is all in white and shades of gray and quite high-tech, lab-like and minimalist. And it's really that juxtaposition between the more softer, warmer, welcoming core and then the more, let's say, laboratory-like manufacturing space around it.
And do you think that gives the visitors a particular experience as they kind of move through the welcome areas into the factory space? Do you think it impacts maybe how they experience the actual manufacturing centers?
Yeah, definitely. We wanted to do something subtle to do with focus, because as you're coming from the town center, you will see that our factory entrance is orientated towards the town center of Schaffhausen. And then you enter this 9-meter-high lobby, whereby your focus suddenly goes up and the scale goes up quite a bit. And then step by step, you focus down until you enter manufacturing, at which point your focus is right on these minute small parts that you see at the beginning of the manufacturing tour, making all the ebauche parts, all the bridges and base plates, which are the smallest of the smallest parts in watch movement. And it's really that idea from opening up and then closing down and zooming in on a very minute detail of watchmaking. And that's kind of what we try to do in this journey through the building.
Yeah, I think you definitely get that feeling also coming from Schaffhausen here. And this building feels both at home and sort of radical in a way in this space. I mean, you have the old town of Schaffhausen, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's an old town.
Exactly.
And then driving out here, you see, you know, along the way, some very modern, typical, uninspired, I guess, industrial parks. But then you get to this big open field with these kind of lush, you know, tree-covered hills, and then this pavilion sitting kind of both in the landscape and on the landscape. It has a really interesting kind of interaction with the site.
Yeah, it is partly a spaceship landed, definitely. And that's what we wanted. It needed to be a standout moment in the environment as well to, you know, just highlight what we do here. And it's quite different from what goes on in these nondescript industrial buildings you described. And at the same time, I think it relates to the site quite a bit. It plays with the levels that we have, the natural gradient we have in the hill, where we have all the heavy machining downstairs on the lower level, which actually sits into the terrain, and then we have all the technical backbone actually underground, and then the lighter watchmaking level, which sits on top and sits at ground floor level, and then the restaurant and penthouse up on the roof. And I think that reacts really well, and the way we oriented it is make sure that all of the views, all the orientation towards the views is all in the green spaces. So where that built-up area is almost blocked out, and you have 270 degrees of green spaces around it that you're actually focusing on.
Great. Yeah, one thing I want to do, you know, if we can go kind of back to earlier in your story, you know, you said that you started working on this museum project and then some boutique projects, and now years later we have this. What kind of happened in that intervening time? How did you go from being, you know, working at an architecture firm, designing a museum on contract, to being the CEO of the company? Can you walk us through that journey?
I wish I knew. No, seriously.
Yeah, I'm just looking for tips, really.
Yeah, no, I think fundamentally what I've learned over the time is that what you do as an architect, and I described it a little bit, you know, you create this system of things that all play together to create one message and one story. And I think what you do as a curator and a guardian of a luxury brand, which is what a CEO essentially is here, is in many ways quite similar, because you have to make sure that everything the client experiences, from the manufacturing to the events to the website to the catalog to everything else, tells the same story, and they all become chapters of that same narrative. And the skills you need for that, and that aesthetic feeling of what is essentially on brand and what is not, is a major factor in how you run a brand like IWC. And I think what you learn as an architect, how to work and choreograph this entire experience is very close to what we do in the watch industry. And then, of course, there's many other skills which you need, which you have to learn on the way, and where you have a very great team to support you. But essentially, I think taste is one of those things that is very, very essential in our industry and that you can't really learn. You know, there's brands that I don't feel. I couldn't make a clear call on this is that brand or not that brand. But IWC was one of those, I think, that's very close to my heart that I got from the very beginning. And then after that, all the other decisions are a lot easier.
What was something along the way in that journey where you said, okay, wait, this is, I have to know how to do this? Like, what was something challenging that you kind of had to learn and maybe struggled with a bit?
Well, finance, definitely. You know, it's not something I had a natural background in, finance and accounting at all. It was something I found fascinating. But yeah, I did have a couple of lessons on the way with my colleagues where I said, you've got to explain this whole EBITDA thing to me and all the rest of it, you know, early on, because you're not familiar with those terms. You know, you don't think in balance sheets and P&L accounts and all the rest of it. So this was definitely something I had to get to grips with, the number crunching side of things. But it's equally fascinating because it gives you a much more holistic picture on how all these different elements come together in a brand like IWC.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that, you know, you said that the taste is something you can't learn, but these other things are kind of skills you can pick up along the way.
Yeah. You can learn how to calculate a margin. You cannot learn how to create a perfect pilot's watch. That's
so for a lot of our listeners, they may not realize, but a lot of, you know, you have a lot of colleagues in other Richemont brands and across the watch industry, at the CEO level. And a lot of them receive very similar training and come from very similar backgrounds. There's a handful, maybe 3 to 5 business schools. And then there's this kind of progression. It's almost like an old school apprenticeship system of, you know, you operate the brand in a smaller market, and then you're moved to maybe be the CMO in a larger market and kind of, you know, work your way up this zigzagging ladder across the globe to become the CEO. Do you find that your approach when you're interacting in a group or a larger industry situation, that you tend to approach things differently because you don't necessarily have that same kind of unified background, or that your interactions with your colleagues are informed by not having that similar background?
Yeah, I think you can always tell what somebody's background and focus is. You know, somebody who's been working 15 years of their career in retail, you can see a retail focus. People who are on the manufacturing side, you can see that. I think over time you develop expertise, but at the same time, I don't think you get to that level unless you have a good holistic grasp of what running a brand is all about and is absolutely essential. What I do think, though, I think the dynamics of looking at resumes is changing. And for me, definitely when I recruit new talents to IWC, I will not have a checklist of previous brand experience or previous business school ticks where I say, okay, unless you have that, we're not even going to talk. I think it's not productive in our environment, because really what we need is, first of all, I need to understand if somebody gets who we are and what we're about. And as I said, I can't teach that. So there needs to be a basic understanding. And after that, I need to understand if somebody can think entrepreneurially, can think creatively, can be agile, act fast, work in a team, and fit our cultural environment. And those things, we always found over time, are much more decisive than whether you have the master's degree of XYZ business school. That's what we're looking for.
And do you think that's something that's changing in the industry, or that others are starting to pick up on as well? Or
yes.
You do?
No, I think so. And I think the dynamic are changing because the environment is changing so fast as well. You know, when I just got out my job description from a few years ago while I was flicking through some documents the other day, and you know, even 6-8 months down the line, probably the jobs we did had not much to do with the job description that we originally signed up for. So you're in this constantly dynamic changing environment where yesterday we're doing certain things a certain way, but this may be radically different 3 months down the line. We opened this manufacturing center with a certain setup. We've changed twice already since we opened the configuration, because we constantly learn new things. And in that, you constantly need new skills, new outlook, new ideas. And that is much more important than having a very sound training one certain way, and then it's going to run like this for the next 20 years. Not the case anymore.
Yeah, this idea of learning things and engaging with kind of what's around you is something that I definitely associate with you and with IWC these days. I wanted to talk about your Instagram profile and how we'll also link this up in the show notes so people can check it out if they don't already follow you. But you're not just actively posting on Instagram and posting from brand events and posting pictures of watches, but you've actually used your Instagram to launch products. Like, products have come out of your engagement with customers and collectors on Instagram. Can you talk about that a little bit and kind of share some stories?
Yeah, so in the beginning, it was really, I was completely new to the Instagram space. So prior to becoming a CEO, I didn't even have an Instagram profile. Out of the social media escape, Instagram immediately appealed to me because it is visual and it is picture content heavy, which is the way I think and the way I do things. So, and from the beginning, I felt it was vitally important, despite having no experience whatsoever, to do this myself and to do it unplanned and to interact authentically with the audience. Otherwise, I think this channel, you know, it's not just another corporate PR channel. It's either personal and it's from me, or to me, it didn't make any sense. So yes, I learned obviously the hard way how to do things, what works. What
I'm sure
work
your PR team loved that.
Well, yeah, I think there's the retail team that love me most for it, because obviously sometimes I post things that lead to numerous phone calls to our various boutiques. And I've been asked many times to submit a content plan well in advance. And I explain time and again, my dear friends, I don't have a content plan until it pops into my head and I do it. So that's a little bit sort of the rogue, you know, nature of that activity. But what happened was basically, you know, we had sometimes, you know, I post bespoke things or things that I've had assembled and that we're testing, and you know, it just becomes part of the story. And there was this one incident what led to the tribute to 5002 Safari watch, where I got an immediate huge feedback from the audience saying, oh my god, you gotta make this. And I thought about it. I thought, well, we had no plans of making this. So I thought about it for a while, and then I commented and said, well, listen, if you get 50 people behind it who want this watch, I'm more than happy to make it. And I think we had quite a few more than 50 very quickly who said God put me on the list, and who put their limitation numbers on all the rest of it. And I went back to the team and we talked about it. I said, okay, let's do it. And I thought, okay, I'll give all these people who in the beginning said, oh, you know, I'd like number 27, number 28, we give them a chance, and developed a system how through DM we can have an Instagram embedded ordering reservation process that would be fulfilled via our boutiques. And that happened very manually in a course of about 48 hours. Those 100 watches were allocated. And some 8 to 9 months later, we managed to deliver them all via the boutiques. And it's really interesting to see how at events globally, it's always these watches come out and people have started to identify all 100 of them on Instagram, try and find all the profiles and get them together. And I think it's beautiful because that's an authentic, unplanned story that's really based on, you know, engagement with our clients, with our fans. And, you know, it's just natural, you know. It's not something you plan and say, oh, I'm going to do this, but if it happens out of the organic way the channel works, fantastic.
Yeah, I think we often in the watch industry run into this kind of old school mentality of there are markets, the markets are segmented, there's boutiques, there's retailers, there's kind of these constructs that we set up and everything has to be done according to plan and according to the quote unquote like way of doing things. Mm. And I'm sure when you said, you know, we're going to sell 100 limited edition watches via Instagram, I'm sure there were people who said, wait, what? That's not how we do things. How do you think, you know, kind of rethinking the structure, the typical structure of things, can kind of give you a leg up on connecting to consumers?
Yeah, I think we have to realize that the path to purchase or that entire process is changing, you know, the way that our clients collect information and in the end make a decision to purchase a watch is very dynamic, you know, and we see already, even if we look at the figures this year, how much more web traffic is driven from social channels directly onto web, and then you can argue how long is that going to be that way until it's fully embedded in social, and it will change again after that. But what it does do is it just opens up new avenues for people to find things and a new way of creating brand similarities, because what happens essentially is on one profile that you trust and value, you find references to other brands, and then you go and discover those and discover products that you love. And that path to purchase is completely different from the traditional way where you depended on maybe a shop, for example, curating certain brands together and recommending this brand next to another one. Today, that journey of discovery is different. The engagement is different. Then you ask your friends. They're also following those accounts. They're commenting. They like the product, etc. And it creates new ways of interaction and new ways of purchasing. And I think that's just the reality of the space we're in today, that we're not in this monodirectional broadcasting world of having an offer out once a year, and then, you know, it's all one message, one way. It's much more dynamic, and I think that's a great, great benefit for the entire industry.
Yeah, so we're recording this in December, and SIHH is right around the corner. People will be hearing this after SIHH so that we can have the following conversation, which is, you know, we got
How
to
did
see...
It go?
Yeah, exactly. At this time, it was an amazing SIHH.
It was brilliant.
You know, this year at SIHH, you know, we got a little sneak peek here at the manufacturer this week, but it's all about pilots this year, which is, I think for me, the thing I most associate with IWC.
Yes.
To me, it's the most quintessentially IWC
Absolutely.
Family of watches.
Absolutely.
Before we get into the specifics of this year's releases, you know, the pilot is so closely associated with IWC, and every few years you kind of reinvent and breathe new life into this collection. How do you balance doing something that feels genuinely new and something that consumers and collectors should pay attention to without going so far so as to stray away from the things that make it what it is and make it your history?
Yeah, I think it's always a balancing game between continuity and your iconic designs especially and the reinvention around it, you know, and it's sort of the classic 60-40 split. You want to make sure it's essentially like having a Porsche 911 in your collection. You want to make sure you evolve that very gradually and not radically. But then you animate around that with newer designs that are fresher and different that become part of that family and that just take the natural next step of evolution. So I think we're going away from a system that we may have seen in the past at times where there's a radical relaunch every year of full collection, but it's more to add to these collections and animate and evolve them gradually to really give a continuous story.
Great. So now we will get into the weeds on this year's
absolutely.
Collection. So there are essentially three families that have gotten, you know, I guess,
attention.
Sure. Can you walk us through those three families and kind of what the goals were for each of them?
Yeah, so the main pillars really are the Spitfire collection this year. And the Spitfire collection is all about that pure classic Pilot's instrument watch with all in-house manufactured calibers. Then we have the Top Gun collection. The Top Gun collection is the modern execution, the technical execution of the Pilot's watch. And this tells the story of material innovation. So here we bring in colored ceramics and ceratanium, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. And then finally on the Saint-Exupéry Petit Prince, We have three new watches, one of them launching a completely new material for us, which is that hard red gold, which is actually up to 10 times more wear and scratch resistant than conventional gold.
Great. And you know, Spitfire is, for me, of the three, they each have things that make them appealing. But
yeah.
Spitfire, to me, feels, I think, the most interesting.
Yeah.
And feels like it really does do a good job of balancing things that are new and things that are old. For me, the biggest thing are the new case sizes.
Yeah.
I mean, we have 39 millimeter automatics and 41 millimeter chronographs. Have you seen a lot of people wanting classic pilots just a little bit smaller?
Yes, so it's a I want to say anecdotal feedback we definitely notice. I also think that many wrist sizes, you know, this is a very wearable case size, especially in the 41, the chronograph, that sits really well on a large variety of wrists. And I was really impressed so far with the feedback as well. You know, people are really taken to this slightly more moderate case size, just slimming it down a little bit and making sure that you have that iconic pilot's design in maybe a bit more moderate case size. So far, I'm very, very impressed with the feedback. And I think it is a really complementary offering to what we already have in the pilot's collection.
And those watches that exist are not going anywhere. There's still the Mark 18 and the classic pilot's chronograph.
Exactly.
Those, okay.
Yes.
And are we going to be seeing these in-house movements eventually maybe make their way over to those, or is the goal to keep these things separate for now?
No, we'll have to see. I think in principle, we believe that there is a space for both. You know, I think we cover quite a broad range of price points with IWC, with our in-house movements now being available at more price points than before. We think that there is always space for both, and how this will, to see how this develops over the next years.
Yeah. Is there a watch from the collection that's sort of your personal favorite, the one that you think you're probably going to end up wearing the most?
There is quite a few. Actually, one that I'm very excited about is the Top Gun Double Chronograph Ceritanium. But if you wanted to talk about Spitfire, I think I actually really love that Time Zoner automatic. Mm. The Time Zoner, to me, I love the openness and the pureness of that automatic dial. With that convenience of the Time Zoner, which is something I can really do with, which helps a lot to be able to adjust the time quickly between different time zones and not make the movement stop. So essentially the second keeps running while you're changing time zone very simply. And even across the date line, you don't have to readjust the date, which is very convenient when you arrive the other
end. And this
end.
Is the watch that uses the bezel.
It uses the bezel.
Zone, right?
It's almost like a pillbox opening mechanism of pushing the bezel down, then turning and releasing again. So it's a very, very simple way to change time zones. And that, combined with that 46 millimeter, quite prominent case, which I still love to wear, and the textile strap, I think is a really interesting combination. On the Top Gun Ceritanium, for me, that is that classic IWC double chronograph, but in a material that combines all the best of titanium with all the best of ceramics. So you have a material that is basically a titanium with a diffused ceramic layer that goes deep into the material that creates a scratch-resistant, break-resistant, absolutely black metal. So you know all the issues we have with DLC coatings, etc., that they rub off. You don't get that at all with Ceritanium. It cannot break, it cannot scratch. And at the same time, it allows us to make the small parts like pushes and crowns and pin buckles in that black material, which we can't do in ceramic. So you see on our ceramic watches, the pushes and crowns are titanium. On the Ceritanium, we can actually do those in all black as well.
Cool. Yeah, one of the watches that I also really love and want to make sure we talk about is the UTC is back.
Yes,
which is
UTC
like
is back.
It's a classic IWC pilot. It's,
absolutely.
It's one that a lot of people love. I know quite a few people for whom that was their first quote-unquote nice watch.
Yeah.
And then it disappeared for a little while, but we're getting that back
Absolutely.
This year.
And I think you can't have a credible pilots collection without a Zulitom UTC function, because for pilots, it's such an essential part of navigating and submitting flight plans and talking about weather and all the rest of it. So I wanted that back in the collection because it's one of the most essential and purest pilot's watch complications there is. We haven't had it in the collection for quite some time, so I'm very happy it's back.
Cool. And then the other big thing is the bronze cases.
Yeah.
And we've seen a number of bronze watches over the last couple of years. It seems to be a pretty strong trend. Is this a case of, you know, you guys seeing this in the market and identifying, okay, this is a thing customers want. Let's give them a strong option. Or was there some other rationale for deciding to release?
We actually started on the Aquatimer chronograph back in 2013, I think.
Okay.
The first bronze chronograph from IWC.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And we then added the Big Pilot in 2016 or 17 in bronze. And they were both big successes. And we found that the individual patina that you get on these cases is really something that appeals to customers because it makes the watch even more individual. It really takes on the wearer's identity in terms of your wearing behavior, how much sport, what climate you live in, etc. And we really felt that within the Spitfire, the idea was to have that slightly warmer, more luxurious execution in the bronze with the olive green. That goes extremely well together. And it gives you a very warm feel from these watches together with the brown leather. And bronze was the ideal material. And then obviously being sort of inspired by the memories of piloting, this patina, you know, suits that theme really well. We just want to make sure ours is actually food hygiene standard. And we use titanium case backs. So it's from a wearability and health perspective, it's the best bronze material there is. And we make sure that for the finishing, which is now sandblasted, we actually give the future owners of this watch already a good impression of where the color is going to go. Mm. Because when you buy a watch in polished bronze, it's a long way away from the color it's going to have later on when it goes really dark. And with the sandblasted finish we have on the cases, I think it's much closer to the reality of the watch when you wear it.
Mm. So to zoom back out a little bit, you know, IWC is a company that has a rich history of diverse marketing and partnerships. And this is something I think a lot of people know and associate with the brand. There's the Mercedes-AMG partnership. There's the motorsports side. There's the partnership with Spitfire. There's a long connection to the film industry and the movies. I think it's tempting for some people to see this and say, oh, it's all marketing. It's just something to fill advertisements. But, you know, I'd like to think there's more to it than that.
Definitely.
And I wonder if you can talk about, you know, from your perspective, other than giving you some, you know, faces to put in your adverts, what do you think this adds to the experience of owning an IWC?
Well, I think it adds a lot because we have, you know, our history is, as the engineer of fine watchmaking, is slightly different from the artisan approach to watchmaking. So we were always problem-solving watchmakers. And also when you look at our geographic location here, we are actually very close to the German car industry, which just, you know, AMG being an hour and a half up the road. So there is a proximity in mindset and in approach that is quite striking between engineering that is in the car and aviation industry and our type of engineering. At the same time, you know, the whole story of the pilot's watches started with Homburger's son, our owners in the 30s, both being qualified pilots, who basically wanted to create that first pilot's watch that set it all off. Essentially, many of the stories we tell are about a human-machine relationship, be it in racing, be it in the Portuguese with navigation, be it in pilots. And we are really, really concerned with creating authentic stories that people can experience. So every part of it, whether you're talking about Top Gun, which is watches for the new US Naval Elite Aviators, whether it's about Spitfire, which now has a Boby Flight Academy as the only Spitfire flight school behind it that's going to take a Spitfire around the world next year, or whether you talk about our racing watches that have both the Formula One team and AMG and Mercedes Classic Racing and all the rest of it behind it, it's a great story that talks about engineering an incredibly precise product where you need a lot of vision and then hard work, and in the end you have great adventure. And that's a story that appeals to people generally, but we take it much, much further than just talking about it in ads. So with us, whether you have a flight experience with Spitfire or whether you experience classic racing with us in Goodwood, all of this becomes part of our story that we live together with our clients. You know, and that gives it an authenticity that people immediately understand. And that, I think, is much more engaging than just using a partnership or face to say, look, this watch was inspired by Spitfire. No, this watch is Spitfire. It is the story nowadays.
And specifically with Spitfire, while we're talking about that, you have a pretty cool activation with them coming up this year, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. So there's the idea of the longest flight. And really, this came from a conversation that we've had all the way back in 2010, where we were looking at different partnerships with the aviation industry. And we came across the Spitfire School and we said, look, we're really interested one day to tell the engineering story of Spitfire and the design story rather than just talking about the military heritage. And then we bumped into each other again last year in their hangar in Goodwood and say, hey, look what we're doing. We're actually refurbishing one of these Spitfires from 1943 to an all-polished exterior that completely focuses on the design and engineering of that beautiful aircraft, and we're going to take it around the world. We said immediately, wow, this is the perfect way now to come together and work on that. And that led to this project, The Longest Flight, which from next August is going to see the Spitfire travel to over 50 countries with huge amount of stopovers, obviously because also the limited range of that aircraft, and many countries Spitfire has never ever been before, and highlighting really the story of engineering and design to audiences all over the planet.
Great. Well, I want to, you know, circle around to something that's not watch related before we start to wrap things up. I know you still have pre-Christmas meetings to get to, so you can get to your holiday. But one thing I wanted to talk about is I know you collect something that's not watches. Can we talk about that for a minute?
If we must.
So what do you collect?
So I collect, oh God, here we go. I collect toy cars from Hot Wheels, a Mattel Matchbox. So that's something I fell into by pure accident, and I think I was really into them as a child. And I've rediscovered that when my son was born back in 2009. And then it's grown into something that's much bigger than my wife would probably want it to be. But yeah, I think, again, it's very interesting what's happening in that space. And, you know, there used to be, when Hot Wheels came to the market in 1968, they actually took the static model car that was already plentiful in 1/64 scale and turned it into two things. A, it was really inspired by a lifestyle trend rather than automotive engineering. So it was a hot rod culture in California that led to this idea of creating interpretations of cars that are just much more appealing and much cooler. And that sort of reflect on the fashion and culture of the time, and at the same time, a toy that's fast, and that actually works, and that's actually the fastest wheels out there. So the play value was upped by millions, and it became the biggest selling toy in the world, and it's also the biggest car manufacturer in the world with their output. That fascinated me, the way it's not just a replica, but it interprets what car culture stands for at any given moment in time, and you can really track that through their designs. And today, when you look at all the partnerships from Magnus Walker to Period Correct and all the lifestyle partnerships that Hot Wheels are forging with all different companies from the fashion space, the auto racing space, all that Rauwelt Begriff stuff from Japan, these extreme tuned Porsche, etc. It's really a contemporary reflection of what car culture is and what it means to people. And that, in a toy, as an aspirational object, I always found fascinating.
That's super cool.
No,
it's super, super cool. I know nothing about the Hot Wheels space. So, and I thought about doing some research before coming to talk to you, but I figured instead of me doing the research, I would make you tell me the research. Yeah. I think it'd be more interesting for our listeners. So I wonder what makes a good or desirable Hot Wheels car as a collector? Like, what are you looking for when you're collecting?
I think the difference between them and many other model cars is they look dynamic. They look like they're speeding even when they're standing still. And then you have something which is quite unique because I relate to it from our space. The best Hot Wheels really feel luxurious. They're, at the end of the day, a $1 toy, and that's incredible. They've been $1 since 1968, since they first came.
And they're still $1?
They're still $1, even 98 cents. Not in any other markets. You know, if you go to Switzerland, right. UK, et cetera, they're much more. But in the US, essentially, they're still 98 cents. And the fascinating thing, despite that, is also that it has preempted the drop culture that you see from all major fashion brands nowadays. Hot Wheels has been doing this since 1968. Everything they do is essentially a one-shot that gets used to be manufactured in Hong Kong, Thailand, now being manufactured in Malaysia. And it goes into a case set selection, which is curated by hand. So each case comes with 72 cars. They're hand-picked by almost like the same job profile as a whiskey blender. And then in there, they have what they call a super treasure hunt. And this is like a 1 in 30,000 car with special finish that is hidden, like the golden ticket in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory is hidden in these different sets and then shipped out of Malaysia. Nobody knows where they're going to show up. And after that, some things may only ever appear in Brazil or Canada or Europe, and other things you may never see. And when they're gone, they're gone. So there's no ordering of specific models. There's nothing unless you find them or later on buy them on eBay for inflated prices. If you're not there when they drop, you don't get it. You know, we had the other day, there is a collaboration with Period Correct out of Costa Mesa in LA. And they did 190 Evolution Mercedes-Benz, which is super iconic with period-correct livery. It sold out on their website in under a minute. And the craze, you know, it was a Saturday morning, 9 a.m. I actually got shut down during the payment process. I had it in my basket and it did on 9 o'clock sharp. And during just entering the PayPal details, sold out, bang. And it's the success that a basic toy car, a $1 toy, gathers today is quite amazing. And I think the design team there, they've done an absolutely incredible job at making and keeping that relevant.
That's super, super cool.
It's my geeky side. There we go.
And so talking about the geeky side, are you a mint in box kind of guy or do you open them up?
I open them up.
Yeah?
Because I want to enjoy them. I want to roll them across my desk and I want to see what they look like in action.
And do you find, has your son gotten into it as well?
No, he hates it.
Really?
No, I think I overexposed him to the cars so early on that now what he actually does, he plays Lego in my museum room. So he doesn't touch the cars. No, he doesn't seem to be bothered.
But Lego is a good toy for the son of an architect.
Absolutely,
That's a respectable thing.
Yes, that's much more respectable than Hot Wheels. And obviously you can imagine I'm into Lego as well. Because Lego gives you obviously great, great creativity in building and all the possibilities, and it's another fascinating toy.
So we usually wrap the show up by asking for a cultural recommendation, for something that you recommend our readers go check out afterwards. But I want to kind of riff on that idea this time and ask you, what is your grail Hot Wheels car? What is the car that you just, if you found it, you would snap it up immediately, but you can't seem to track down?
There are a few. No, there is a host of special releases that never see the public eye, starting with what Mattel does in El Segundo once a year. It's a toy fair for their dealers. They release models there that are incredibly hard to find. And then they have models that only go to their key employees in manufacturing to say thank you once a year. And in 2016, there was a Porsche 911 GT3 RS that actually had white dish wheels on a pure white exterior that comes in a little display case. I have not found this once anywhere available for sale. If somebody, if you Houdinki listeners got one, let me know.
Yeah, if anybody knows, seriously, tweet at us.
That would be one I would absolutely go for straight away.
Any chance we see an IWC Hot Wheels?
I'm working on it.
You're working on it?
Yes, because all obviously right. The partnership with Mercedes-Benz AMG helps a little bit here. So
perfect.
Yes, I would love to do that.
Amazing. Great. Well, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
I know it's busy pre-SIHH, and by now everyone's seen the collections, and we'll link up to some of our coverage of the new collections too. So thanks so much. It's always a pleasure to sit down and chat.
Thank you, Stephen. Great to have you. Thanks a lot.
This week's episode was recorded at the new IWC Manufakturzentrum in Schaffhausen, Switzerland, and was produced and edited by Grayson Corhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.